Welcome back to Hot Takes and Deep Dives, and today I am joined by one of the most prolific songwriters and producers in the history of pop music. Not only has Walter Afanasieff written for Beyoncé, Destiny's Child, Ricky Martin, Josh Groban, Barbara Streisand, and produced part of the Bodyguard soundtrack with Whitney Houston, but he is perhaps most notable for his 28 songs co-written with Mariah Carey. I'm talking about the enormous hits from her early albums, including One Sweet Day, My All, Hero, Anytime You Need a Friend, plus deep cut fan favorites like Forever, Whenever You Call. But Walter, would you say All I Want for Christmas Is You will be your lasting legacy?
I would say, yeah, All I Want for Christmas Is You is the most reoccurring chart positioning over and over over the last 25, 26 years. You know, occasionally somebody will put on an old Mariah Carey record or a Celine Dion record or whatever, but it isn't the same as having a radio blasting for literally 6-7 weeks straight this very famous Christmas song. My kids can be very grateful because they all went to college on that song. There's been a lot of genuinely, and we're all very grateful. I'm always grateful to Mariah for having the wherewithal and the power and the sort of the staying power to be the Christmas queen every mm-hmm. year. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of people out there writing great Christmas songs, and the original Christmas song is something that I'm very, very in favor of people doing, because not because I want to dethrone the song that I had co-written, but because it's really, really a wonderful subject matter and really brings out a very beautiful side of songwriting. And it could be fun, it could be religious, it could be classical or pop or rock or whatever you want. And there's no rules or regulations when it comes to Christmas songs. And I think that that's probably the reason why All I Want for Christmas Is You is what it is because it didn't follow any flavor of the month or,
right.
You know, what was current on the radio at that time and so forth or so on. It just came out. We did it kind of like in an old rock kind of way. It doesn't have a genre or a year or, it's an open.
It's timeless.
It's timeless. Yeah, it's an open thing for everyone in anything, any age, every country in the world. You know, it's a non-denominational sort of a song. So,
Walter, give everyone a brief history of the partnership between you and Mariah.
Mariah and I were like two peas in a pod. We were, you know, partnered in so, like you said, so many songs, so many albums. She came into my life sort of unexpectedly. I was working for another producer back in the late 80s, and this very, very young, very gifted, unknown singer showed up doing her first album. And we all got to know her we were all working on the song Vision of Love. And the producer that I was working with, Narda Michael Walden, was given this young artist to produce and to co-write with. He wrote, I think, I Don't Want to Cry with her. It was just like unknown new artist that just showed up out of nowhere. And the luckiest day of my life is because I was working on some of her music, but not in the studio where she was doing her vocals with my boss, Narda Michael Walden. I was in another studio completing tracking and so forth on other songs that he was producing, but I was his arranger, sort of a ghost co-producer. You know, like I was his band because we used to do everything on a computer. And at the time, nobody knew that they were ever going to be involved romantically or end up getting married. But her boss and our boss for the moment was Tommy Mottola, who was the head of, at that time, even CBS Records, which then became Sony Music. And Tommy has a very, very particular knack of really wanting to know who's doing what and who did what and who's responsible for this. And so he started walking around and going in his way, asking questions like, who did all the music on these songs that were here that Mariah's singing on? And everyone in the studio said, well, Narda's guy, Walter, pretty much does all the tracking and all the arranging and all the sort of stuff. And he goes, really? So Narda doesn't play anything on these records. But chances are if there are songs like, you know, the ones we were working on, it's all computerized and it's all pretty much Walter, who's doing all this, the bulk of the programming and the music. So he's kind of started thinking about it, and he actually called me. This is after we were done, she left, and everybody was finished the project. He asked me, can I do one more song for the record? And the album actually came out already. The first version of her first album, Mariah Carey, didn't have Love Takes Time on it. It was a very, very short-lived first version, which then he halted the release of that version of the album. And he said, if you can do me one more song, and you have literally 24 hours to do this, one day of programming, get on an airplane, come to New York, do her vocal, literally 24 hours, we need to put this on this album as yet another song. And if you could do it, you know, it would be really cool. So I said, of course, I'll do my best. What I didn't know is he was actually testing me. He's like, if this is true that you were really the guy who did all that stuff, then you're going to be good enough to do what I'm asking you to do. So I took, you know, this little demo that he sent me that Mariah and Ben Margulies, her at that time, that was her songwriting partner. And I did this track and flew to New York, and we did her vocal and mixed it. And literally 24, almost 48 hours later, they had the finished product. And it was her second single after Vision of Love that went number one. And Tommy was so pleased with my, you know, my abilities that he offered me, you know, a position at Sony Music to be an exclusive staff producer. And he started to really groom her, Mariah, and me to 86 Ben Margulies out, and for her to start doing the bulk of her writing, and her partnership songwriter partner would be me.
Wow.
But nobody, yeah, so nobody really knew at the time how big she was going to be. So I was like, yeah, sure. So I started to literally commute Monday through Friday, go to New York, hang out with her, and most of our songwriting started. If you look at the chronological order of all of our songs that we wrote, the very first songs that we started writing together, and then it eventually led to, you know, Music Box and Hero and Anytime You Need a Friend and all the really, really good stuff. And along the way came this Christmas album that we, you know, at that time, we were already so like partnered and so happy to be each other's partner songwriter. And I was working with the great Mariah Carey, who was this number one selling artist. So the notion came up that we were going to do this Christmas album. So got off the subject of what I was trying to explain to you.
No, this is fascinating. This is fascinating.
So because we were so tightly partnered, and at that time the relationship with Tommy became stronger and fuller and more intense, and eventually it was them getting married. So I was really, really dear friends, and I still am really good friends with Tommy Mottola. Mm-hmm. But we were like the three of us would go everywhere. Like we would, if they go out to dinner, it would be the three of us. I would constantly lived in their homes when I went to New York to stay with them, except for the fact that when they used to live in New York City, when they were building this beautiful home in Westchester County, I would stay in a hotel. But more or less after they moved out of the city, it would always be me going to their home. And certainly if they were on a summer vacation, they would either lease a house or rent a house on the Hamptons or wherever we ended up doing. Mm-hmm. But it was always me staying in their house. And because of their strong marriage and all of our strong sort of relationships together, it was a very devastating blow that they fell out of love. And then Tommy and Mariah ended up getting a divorce. And it wasn't a mutual, you know, they stayed friends divorce. It was a very powerful dissolution of marriage. You know, they weren't speaking, and they were very, very bitter.
I just want to ask, like, did you read her book?
No.
Okay. But I'm sure you're aware of her version of the story was that he was heavily, she became complete. He had her completely secluded and watched, and her every move was tracked. Like it was a real oppression that she felt. That was her, that is her point of view. That was her experience.
Well, I certainly don't doubt she said all of those things and wrote them in her book, because it's no different in her mind than the story of how we wrote the song All I Want for Christmas Is You. So when they divorced and everyone went their separate ways, I was still under contract with Tommy and with Sony Music. So I couldn't just abandon that ship and run off into the sunset with Mariah. So she was very bitter about that. So she left all of us kind of like, I don't need you guys anymore. I'm on to my next love and my next romance and my next chapter of my musical career. Having said all that, we never got back together again as songwriters, you know.
There's two versions of how, you know, out there of how this song was written. There's Mariah's version and there's your version. I want to hear your version of how the song was written.
At that time, we were both on the same exact page of how we wrote All I Want for Christmas Is You. There was never any ulterior or alternate story, alternate universe, alternate reality until probably 10 years ago, which she started to sort of like hint at the fact that, I wrote that song when I was a little girl. Like, but why weren't you saying that for 12 or 13 or 15 years prior to that? So it just kind of sort of developed in her mind. But she doesn't play anything. She doesn't play keyboard or piano, or she doesn't understand music. She doesn't know chord changes and music theory or anything like that. She doesn't know a diminished chord from a minor 7 chord to a major 7 chord. I mean, all of the things that you need to know, even if you don't know, at least you need to know how to play that. So to claim that she wrote a very complicated chord structured song with her finger on a Casio keyboard when she was a little girl, it's kind of a tall tale. I mean, it's like, it's a difficult song.
So tell me, how was the song written?
I mean, we were holed up in this beautiful home that they were renting, and it was in the summertime, and there was a piano. I think maybe it was even like Alan Menken's house that they were renting for the summer. And we were tasked with the writing of 3 songs. We were going to do a Christmas album, but we weren't going to write the whole Christmas album. We decided to write 3 originals for the Christmas album. And this is after we've written 100 songs already. So there's no question when she and I go into a room to write a song, it's because we've done it so, so many times. The 3 songs that we decided to do for this Christmas album that we were about to start making were, one was a very nice, beautiful, romantic kind of a song, which we ended up writing called I Miss You Most at Christmas. Second song we decided to do was more of a religious sort of Jesus Born on This Day, it was called. And then the third song we decided to do was a fun, up-tempo, kind of a cool, you know, not like, like I said, non-denominational. It's just a very happy, teetering on love, but more so on the Christmas, you know, fireplace and reindeers click and Santa Claus and mistletoe and all the, you know, stereotypes. So when we're writing these 3 songs, it wasn't like, well, I'm only there for 2 because she already wrote the 3rd when she was a little girl on a Casio keyboard with 1 finger. Would she be able to show it to me? Mariah, go ahead, play the chords. Play 1 chord, you know? So it wasn't like that. It's an impossibility that she and I did not write a song that we are both credited with 50% each on. It's not like we're Lennon and McCartney. We had some kind of a written agreement that no matter if you write it or I write it, we're always going to be the 2 of us.
That's a great point.
Now, mind you, Mariah was the principal and main writing that she did was melody kind of help in the creation of the melodies. And I would be all of the music and the chords and everything.
And she would do all of the lyrics as well.
She would do all the lyrics. Yeah. So the writing of All I Want for Christmas is I started playing sort of a boogie woogie kind of a rock. Boom, 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 boom. And it was in anyone who knows music, the bass, and the chord is, so I'm trying to go,
and are you writing it on an actual keyboard, or you're doing this on a computer?
No, I'm sitting at a piano.
Okay, got it.
Now, when the bass line is playing, Mariah was and this is my opinion, but it's sort of a musicologist in me opinion, because I've studied music. I have degrees in music. I'm an accomplished orchestrator, arranger. I could teach music. I'm not like a schlump. I don't play by ear.
You're a Grammy winning producer. No, you're no schlump, Walter.
You know, I've studied, you know, music my whole life, but it is my opinion that the bass line of a ba 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 gave her the idea to go, I don't want a love. So she changed the last two notes, but it was kind of that feel that gave her this, I don't want a lot for Christmas. And then I go to the four chord, like a rock and roll pattern would do. Bum, ba, dum, da, da, da. That's a really complicated chord, but I like to do things a very different way. So I stuck that chord, which forced her to sing the note that has to be in that chord. Otherwise, it's not the right note. So on. And it was like a game of ping pong.
Yeah.
I hit the ball to her. She hits it back to me. I hit it back to her. She hits it back to me. So the exchange of my piano playing, bass lines and melodic ping pongs at her, she would then, all I want for, what would be a cool chord there? Christmas, another complicated chord that she could never have written with her finger on a Casio when she was a little girl. Is you know, and that's our ping pong writing of the song sort of back and forth.
I love this.
She then, you know, she didn't write all the words, lyrics in that session. It was just the music of it. So after having written these three beautiful original song ideas, they're not finished yet, but we have enough of music that I then took it to my home studio in California, and I started to plot the arrangements and the production of these songs, as well as of some of the other songs that are on the album that I produced. When I started to develop the All I Want for Christmas Is You track, then it became all computerized, because it's really hard to play that real fast piano thing throughout the whole song. It's just crazy hard. So she started to finish the lyrics to this song. And I remember she would call me in like all hours of the night or whatever, because she stayed up really late all the time. What do you think? Do you like the, you know, reindeer's click, or should it be something else? And she would like throw ideas and have me sort of give my opinions and help her finalize some of these wonderful mistletoes and Santa Claus. And so I felt at the time that it was a very collaborative, very, very partnered, certainly in All I Want for Christmas. So the point being is that painfully and unfortunately, Mariah and I parted ways. And I do agree to the fact that he was very, very hands-on in her career. He guided her career like it was a precious diamond. It was a very, very precious thing. And he made no qualms about it. He wasn't like, you know, doing things, hey, you got to do me a favor because this girl sucks. And, you know, I know she can't sing, but you got to play her record on the radio. And don't worry, I'll buy you a house if you do it. No, she was a just incredibly talented, wonderful artist of his that he really, really made a stellar career out of. And a lot of us, I mean, there's more people involved than maybe some people know. There was Babyface involved. There was Corey Rooney involved. There was Colin Clavillis. There was, you know, there was a lot of folks that were really, really happy to be involved. And they worked with her, some of the R&B guys and some of the more up-tempo songs that she had. And certainly Ben Margulies, who wrote probably most of her first and even second albums. You know, it takes a village. In this case, any artist who has such a wonderful achieved career, such a high level of career success, she didn't do it alone. She didn't do a one finger on a Casio when she was a little girl, if you know what I mean. So yeah, there was a lot of us who helped her.
A song like All I Want for Christmas Is You, like the success that it wound up having, I would assume for a songwriter, it's like winning the lotto.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't imagine it's winning the lottery. Not, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of money that song makes. However, my...
No, I don't mean in terms of money. Yeah, I mean in terms of the chance that a song you write is... Not only is it going to be a top 10 hit, but it's going to go number one and then sustain for the next 25 years. And literally, it went number one last year, 25 years after its release.
Yeah. I've never heard of anything like that.
When was the last time you spoke to Mariah?
The last time I spoke to Mariah was literally, I think, 4 years ago.
Oh.
But before that, I hadn't talked to her for almost 20 years. Now, the 4 years ago moment came because she was about to release her book called All I Want for Christmas Is You. It was a children's book. And in the book, the book is just the lyric of the song. Obviously, you don't hear music when you read a book. And obviously, it's a children's book. But it is called All I Want for Christmas Is You. And it's, I don't want a lot for Christmas. And there's a picture. And then you turn the page. And obviously, it's because it's copywritten in both of our names. We both own any part, the title, the lyrics, the music. It's both of our song. She needed my permission to release the book. But anyway, she called me literally out of the blue. I'll never forget this. I was in Seattle, Washington on a business trip. And I looked down at my phone, and it was a 310 number, and I didn't recognize the number. And for some reason, and I normally would never have answered it. But for some reason, I said, hello. And the voice said, hi, is this Walter? And I go, yes. She goes, do you have a minute to speak to Mariah? And I go, Mariah who? And she goes, Mariah Carey. And I go, is this a joke? She goes, no, this is her manager, blah, 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 or her assistant or whatever. And Mariah would love to speak with you if you have a moment. And I go, okay, let's see how far this goes. Because I thought it was a joke. And all of a sudden, it was her voice. Hi, you know, hi, Walt. She's called me Waldo. Hi, Waldo. It's Mariah. And I went, like, I literally almost burst out in tears. Like, I was like, I can't believe it's you. Yeah, it's me. How are you? How have you been? So, ba, 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 ba. And I go, okay, so what's going on here? Well, I'm calling you to see if you would please tell your publishing company to do a favored nations thing where both take the same exact deal of money or whatever regarding this book. And you know, it's the only fair thing to do, Walter, because you didn't write the lyrics. I did. And the book is just the lyrics. And I go, well, you know, I'll see about helping this. Yeah, of course I would love to. But if I do you a favor like this, would you do me a favor? Would you ever consider writing again with me?
Mm.
You know, because there's really just absolutely no reason that I can think of after 20 years or almost that you and I have not been writing together because we wrote some of the most beautiful songs. And she goes, yeah, I'm going to be in LA in the next week or two, and I'll have my office call you to set it up. I think that would be really good. I think it's time for that, she said. And I go, oh, well, thank you. That would be amazing. I wish you well, you know, all my love, and I'll talk to you soon. And that was it. Of course, it never happened. She never called me, and that was 4 years ago.
But she may. Like, well, she's only had like one album come out in the last four, you know, it may happen.
If it happens, I would be the happiest person on earth, literally.
I mean, let's just say All I Want for Christmas is the gold standard for modern day Christmas pop songs. Are there any others that have been written in the, you know, since All I Want for Christmas that you feel even come close? Or are they really just all trying to be All I Want for Christmas Is You?
There's a lot of songs are specifically patterned after All I Want for Christmas. And I could see why, because people want to have a little taste of that success, you know?
Like which songs in particular?
I don't know. I think maybe like the last Kelly Clarkson last year, she had a really up, sort of an up song. There's been a few out there, but they're kind of in that old, kind of a faster rock and roll. The thing is, Christmas songs should be open and free. And it's just a rolling of the dice. It's one of those things where you just never know. And obviously, we never expected in a million years that All I Want for Christmas Is You would even be even come out. And I think because it is such a distinct and such a happy feeling, people have been trying to capture a similar kind of, you know, moment in their songwriting of a Christmas song. Now, I remember being in the studio and David Foster, I think, was producing Michael Bublé's Christmas album.
Yeah.
And we're all really, really good friends. As a matter of fact, they actually put
He do a cover of All I Want for Christmas is
Yeah,
he, like did, a, he slowed it. He slowed it down.
Yeah,
to a
slowed
ballad.
It down. Yeah, he did a ballad version. I remember. But anyway, I was visiting with David, and he was working on the album, and I kind of came out with, "Hey, man, why don't we try writing a song? Let's, you know, let's write a song for Michael." And David goes, "Oh no, man, no. There's no more original Christmas songs allowed. That door shut with your song, dude." And I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Oh no, your song, All I Want for Christmas Is You, is the last song ever to enter in the Christmas canon of songs, and that vault is sealed." And I'll never forget. I felt really bad about that. I go, I don't believe that. I really don't. Like, even if I wanted to have another Christmas stab at a Christmas song, I think it's very unfortunate that somebody would say, "No, don't write any more Christmas songs."
Well, you know, for what it's worth, you know, Mariah even had an entire second album of Christmas songs. And now her song, which it's almost like a decade old, but she does have this other single off her second Christmas album called Oh Santa. And now this is suddenly a huge hit 10 years later because she did the video with Ariana Grande and Jennifer Hudson. And it's an amazing song.
For this year, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, well, good for her.
Yeah.
So even the great Mariah Carey, the queen of Christmas songs, has, you know, has the right to come out with another, try to have another successful Christmas song. But I'll tell you, so I urge songwriters every single year, try to write the next All I Want for Christmas.
You know, just switching gears off of Mariah, you've...
Yeah.
I mean, like I mentioned, you've won a Grammy for... producing Celine Dion, the Titanic theme song, My Heart Will Go On. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that. How did that song come about? So that song was already written and you were tapped to produce it?
Yeah. So having this wonderful job of being a Sony music producer, Celine Dion and I, you know, our beginning of our sort of relationship started with Beauty and the Beast. And that was a long time before My Heart Will Go On. So she was, an unknown singer from Canada who was just starting her American English language career. And we were all sort of Sony people, and she was signed to Sony Epic Records. So we all got an opportunity to work with her or to see. It's almost like, you know, Tommy knew, like if you throw a bunch of stuff against the wall, let's see what sticks, you know, because not everything always worked. He was a very smart guy, though. He would give 10 record deals to 10 different artists. And he knew not all 10 would make it, but he knew some of them would, and some of them would make it really big. One of the artists that I was asked to work with was Celine, and it was for this movie, Beauty and the Beast, which at that time was like, are you kidding me? A song that has the Beauty and the Beast in the title? It's from a cartoon about a beast? That's crazy. So anyway, and then they actually chose this pretty unknown male singer, Peebo Bryson, and of this very, very... totally unknown French singer, French Canadian singer, Celine Dion. But it worked out really, really well. And then they continued her career, and her career started to really, really grow and grow and grow. And she had a massive amount of success. And then at the time of Titanic, movies that are made love to have songs in them. And there's two ways to get a song in a movie. You either pay for a very famous existing song. So if you want to put a Beatles song in a movie or a Rolling Stones song in a movie or a Billy Joel song in a movie, you have to be able to afford it. And that artist or the owner of that song can go, "Well, you could play our song, but you have to pay us $5 million or some ridiculous thing." or you could have an original song written for that movie. An original song is easy to get written because there's a million writers out there who would love to write for any kind of a movie 24 hours a day. Now we have to get somebody very famous to sing it. That's a little different. Not every record company gives out their artists to just any old movie to sing any old song.
In fact, Hero was originally designed to be written for a movie called Hero.
Correct. It was Mariah and I writing a song for Gloria Estefan.
But in the end, I think like Tommy was like, actually, no, you're going to keep this and put this on your album. It's not going to go to Gloria Estefan for the movie. You're going to put on your album and it's going to be a mammoth hit. And she like didn't even like it. She didn't even believe it was going to be a hit.
Exactly. That's a very good point. And that's a very good story. When we were writing Hero, in her mind, it was for someone else. It was for a movie. And she had no reservations. She had no boundaries. She just wrote freely. And it was that freedom and not being, well, I want a song just like that, or I want a song just like this song is on the radio right now, or I want a song that has a formula to it. We were just writing a beautiful song. And so Tommy did walk into the studio and he goes, what were you guys just doing? What was that? I was in the other room and I heard you guys playing and singing something. And Mariah goes, oh, well, yeah, Walter and I were writing a song for film Hero, and Gloria Estefan is going to sing it. He goes, let me hear it. And so it's not finished. He goes, I know, just play what you have. Just let me hear. So I started playing. Just listening. There's a hero. And she starts singing, la 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 da 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 da. And then a hero comes. We kind of play it, and he goes, stop. He goes, you're not giving that song to anyone. Mariah, you're going to record that song. And it's one of the best songs you guys have ever written. And I mark my words, if you put the song out, it'll be one of your biggest hits of your career, like that. And she looked at him, she goes, what? I'm not recording that song. No, this song's for somebody else. I would never record that song. And he goes, trust me, just trust me, you got to do the song. When she actually... It was a little like pulling like her teeth. I don't know. She was very uncomfortable. When we were doing the vocal, she wanted to sing runs and her licks all over the place. It was a very, very like uncomfortable feeling for her to really sing just a straight melody,
To like tone it down, like sort of a straight shot. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's a handful of women, who have been doing that. Christina Aguilera, Beyonce, Celine a little bit, but Mariah wanted to like always do her beautiful licks and runs and acrobatics. And when she was singing Hero, he came in the room and he goes, you're all over the place. You're singing it too complicated. It just needs to be a beautiful, like the melody. You wrote the melody, sing the melody. And she didn't want that. She goes, I don't want that. And then he would tell the engineer, don't erase that last take, and she's like, no, erase that, she didn't, she was very insecure.
Wow.
It turned into an arm wrestle between Tommy and her. And in the end he won because it's his company and it was his artist and, he's the boss.
Exactly.
And he goes, trust me, Mariah, this is going to be a big song. She didn't like the vocal that we comped in the Tommy vocal, but look what happened. It was a huge, huge hit.
So My Heart Will Go On.
So My Heart Will Go On was chosen because there was a little bit of a politic thing. James Cameron had James Horner and Will Jennings write this song, and it was his desire, James Horner's desire, to have Celine do it because Celine at that moment was an amazingly huge artist. Because I was Sony and really, really successful producer at that time. This was like 1996, 1997. It was like my heyday. I was like on fire and everyone knew that I was producing Celine Dion. So they sent me, I'll never forget, it was, I can't remember now, somebody sent me this little demo and it was just a piano and Celine's demo vocal. And I listened to it, and it was like, every night in my dream, it was so boring and stupid. And I was like, are you kidding me? This is the song they chose for, what's the movie? Oh, yeah, it's a movie about that ship, Titanic. You know, the one that hits the glacier and sinks.
Iceberg, yeah.
I go, oh, God, what a stupid song for a stupid movie about a stupid ship. Like, all right, whatever, you know. So they go, well, just do it up, man. Do your thing. Put your magic touch on it. So I produced the crap out of it. We did penny whistles and orchestra, Bill Ross, and I had, you know, Dan Huff playing guitars. I had my crew and my drum programming, blah, 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 you know, and all the stuff that we used to do back in the 90s on really big ballads. That was the most fun decade of music. And then, you know, Celine and Humberto, and we came in and did the vocals. And it was, you know, like, who knew? Again, who knows that this movie was going to be the biggest blockbuster movie of all time.
You were saying how the 90s was the most fun decade to write music. Talk about the difference, how it was for new artists in the 90s, like the Mariahs, versus today in terms of just how the songs are written. Because it seems like now the label, like, songs have to be written a certain way. There's much less freedom, it seems.
Exactly. Well, there is. And it's not just in the music business. It's in a lot of industries. It's commerciality has become more important than quality. And today's songwriter is not how the songwriting was in the 90s or way before. Like, throughout the history of pop music, I remember there were years where you would literally go turn on the Grammy Awards, and there's Aretha Franklin, and there's, you know, the Beatles, and there's Madonna, and there's like everyone and anyone had a shot at a piece of the pie. It was a really wonderful thing. And when you were a songwriter and you were genuinely writing, not because you have to write it a certain way, but you were just free writing. It's that was the whole thing. Paul Simon never went, you know, let's see, what's that song that's number one on the radio and it played for me? Oh, okay, I'm going to write a song like that. No, he's just like writing whatever he wants. Same thing with the Beatles, same thing with Madonna, same thing with the... So when we got our turn at the bat, it was the 90s that was the inning was, you know, 10 innings at 90, 91, 92. So that freedom of writing and freedom of labels giving deals to wonderful and talented people who deserved record deals. Nowadays, it's who could outdo who in the younger generation, gross, you know, whatever, the Cardi B's out there. And I'm sorry, but, you know, even like to me, BTS or there's a number of artists right now that I don't get it. You know, it's fine. It's a free country, free world. Beauty's in the eyes of the beholder. It's subjective. I get all that stuff. But radio has taken over in such a way that they're playing almost like what the Disney Channel used to play for kids. It's now become our pop radio. And inside of it is how many bleeps or how many gross words can we use, and how many F words and how many this and how many that. And certainly because R&B and hip hop sort of became the mainstream in music, that became the structure of today's music is more so in a hip hop place. I was looking at the Grammy Award nominees this morning. I was laying in bed, and I was looking at all the categories that interest me. So the first place I looked is for songwriting, the song of the year, because I always like to see if I know any of the songwriters who are nominated. And I look at the Beyoncé record that's nominated. There's 9 songwriters on that song.
Yes.
It's like 9 songwriters to write that song. Have you ever heard Beethoven or Chopin or Rachmaninoff or
the Beatles?
Like
It's Lennon and McCartney, the end.
You know, how much,
Even Madonna, she always had just like one other. Historically, throughout the 80s and the 90s, she always worked with a single co-writer, co-producer.
Yeah. How about Billy Joel? Like every song.
Could you imagine?
All by himself.
Could you imagine Uptown Girl written by 45 writers?
Yeah. Anyway, it's pretty special what system of songwriting has become. And especially because somebody does it on a computer. It's like a guy who does a track. It's like a beat. And then he gets to be a songwriter. Well, wait a minute. He helped me do the beat. Well, he gets to be a songwriter too. Mind you, it's just a beat. And then over here, you have another guy who's going to be a songwriter because he did the bass line, and that's part of the song. And so the mentality of credit where credit's due as far as songwriters has become very, very shallow. But I do have to say that when it comes to my profession, a songwriting profession, it does kind of strike me as being, I'm not going to say unfair, but just the way the songwriting process and the songwriting community has been so watered down into such a, like, you know, we're not, I mean, I love Sia. I think she can go off and write by herself. Like, and I've written with Beyonce, mind you. You know, she and I wrote a couple of songs that she's a beautiful writer.
For Destiny's Child, right?
Yeah, Destiny's Child.
And so talk about that. How was it to work with Beyonce in a songwriting capacity?
Well, it was wonderful because she, in a certain way, she's no different than Mariah. Joni Mitchell wrote all her own songs. Mariah Carey wrote all of her songs. Hands down.
Like, Whitney, I don't believe, wrote.
Whitney Houston didn't write a single song. Madonna would write a lot of her songs.
Oh, yeah.
So my point is that it's an extraordinary thing. It's, if you're able to be a gifted songwriter and this amazing artist, you know, that's wonderful. But the power of being able to write a song by yourself, like, you know, Diane Warren writes songs by herself usually. A really good lyricist, a storyteller, somebody who could take and really, really write a great lyric, that's a wonderful thing. So I always rely on my lyricists to come in and write lyrics for me. So there's this thing that we've all grown up into having this, either I'm going to do it by myself, the Billy Joels of the world, or I'm going to do it with someone like Paul Simon by himself, Billy Joel by himself, people like that. Lady Gaga is a great writer, but we know, they know, if I'm not going to be able to do it by myself, I can reach out to somebody who can come in and help me do it. Yeah, it's no problem. That's why you used to have, okay, two writers, maybe three. Like, maybe there's a third writer, but that's usually because somebody else is in the room and went, hey, why don't you, instead of saying shove, use the word love. Hey, that's a good idea, Johnny. You're a songwriter with us. Great.
Now you're a millionaire.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But over the last 10, 15 years, you started seeing the sort of the dismantling of the songwriting process.
For a new artist that's trying to break through, or even if you look at like American Idol, where those people were poised to have a shot, you know, if you look at like, you know, Kelly Clarkson, obviously the gold standard, how important is song choice when an artist is putting together their debut album? Isn't song choice everything? The artist having the taste.
Yeah. So here's a tale that I can tell you and your listeners about how important it is to sing, especially as a new artist, especially on your debut album, and just especially as someone who may have become popular by doing a TV show, for instance, like American Idol, or somebody who came out on YouTube and became an instant sensation like Justin Bieber or something like that. There was a girl who was poised to win American Idol many, many years ago. Her name was Pia Toscana. And Pia Toscana was on the show and rising week after week, getting through, and literally everyone thought that she was going to be the next Celine Dion, like insanely talented girl. Beautiful as beautiful can be. Singing like crazy good and singing her type of song on American Idol because her voice and her heart, she chose these beautiful songs. Like she could have sang song Over the Rainbow. It doesn't matter. But the power singer that she was singing so beautifully, and her audience loved her so much. And this is rumor has it that Jimmy Iovine and Interscope Records wanted her so bad, because they knew she was going to be a very important big star, that they sort of kind of sabotaged her American Idol run, and she was voted off. I'll never forget. It was like, what? This girl was going to win, mm-hmm. and now she's getting voted off, in number 9 position. And it was kind of a cool thing, because next day everybody found out, she just got assigned. She just signed a huge record deal with Interscope. Oh, well, it makes sense now. Here's the bad news. Interscope didn't put the type of song that she was now known for and her powerful voice sang. They chose a bunch of pop, what's going to be a big hit on the radio kind of songs. And they gave it to a bunch of songwriters to come up with a bunch of mediocre pop songs that didn't have anything to do with her quality and her artistry. And they shelved the album and dropped her. So now, she never came.
Whose fault is that?
That's the record company's fault.
How could they screw it up like that?
Well, today's record company, publishing company, and record label staff, people who work there, are, in my opinion, not the same person that used to work at record companies and publishing companies back in the 90s or in the 80s. We had strength. We had integrity. We had people who were not afraid to take a chance. Nowadays, all you have are a bunch of young yes men who are all afraid of losing their job. So everyone is looking at, there's nobody who's willing to take a chance the way Tommy Mottola used to take a chance. Or nowadays, we have to have someone with 20 million hits only to even look at them to sign them. You already have to have become famous already for us to even take a look at you by social media and so forth and so on. So it's a whole different ball game in how you get a record deal and how you're going to put out music. I think that the most important thing that music had ever had is integrity. That's why Mariah is Mariah. That's why Celine is Celine. That's why My Heart Will Go On is My Heart Will Go On. That's why Madonna is Madonna. The Beatles are the Beatles. And remember, the very, very legends that we're talking about, they never would have become famous unless they had that first song. That's what it takes. Vision of Love for Mariah Carey was her coming out. Listen to this, everyone.
Yeah.
And somebody had, if I may say, somebody had the balls to put that song in there. That was a 6/8 R&B ballad. It had nothing to do with what was on the radio, okay? But Tommy, Columbia Records, took a shot. And then radio stations and radio programmers, the program directors at radio stations all across the country took a shot. They said, let's see what happens. Nowadays, they're not going to take that kind of shot. They're going to put out that kind of song if it's not already a hit in a different form somewhere else. You know, what you hear is just a regurgitation of what's already famous and popular, you know?
Were there any songs you wrote or produced that became huge that surprised you? That you were kind of like, wow, I can't believe this became a hit?
I think that the most surprise song that became a hit in my life and my career that I wrote or produced is All I Want for Christmas Is You. I really, really didn't ever think in a million years that when that record came out the first year, it's going to come and go like that. Nobody's ever going to play it ever again after the first Christmas season. I literally thought that that's not something that people want Mariah Carey to sing. I really thought that that style of song was never going to be popular. At that time, in 1994, mind you, when you put out a Christmas record back then, it's usually because you're at the end of your career. You would go to Tower Records or Virgin Records, and you would go to the Christmas bin, and those are the on sale for $5 CDs, because nobody, so you either end up in Las Vegas on some stage, it's the end of your career, or your very last thing you do before you die is put out a Christmas album. Okay. So we were playing with this notion that, well, why are we going to wait for Mariah's end of her career to do a Christmas album that normally people do? Let's do it now, like in the middle of her, in the beginning of her career. So I was very surprised at that. But my number one surprise, I think, was when we were doing A Whole New World from the Aladdin, the Disney movie. That going number one with two people that nobody hardly knew, Regina Bell and Peebo Bryson, and it went number one about some genie in Aladdin from some movie. That was like crazy. And I think third place probably is My Heart Will Go On. Like,
because you thought the demo was really lame.
I mean, I thought the song is lame.
I want to just run down, if you have any anecdotes about working with these people, like you've wrote and produced for the following people, and this is an amazing list. So we have Beyonce, just any anecdotes that jump out. Beyonce, okay. Savage Garden, Ricky Martin, Josh Groban, Barbara Streisand, Aretha Franklin, and of course, Whitney Houston. I know you played keyboards on I Want to Dance with Somebody. In that list, like what jumps out at you? Like any memories from working with these people?
Beyonce is probably, in my opinion, the most, like she is a light. She's just beautiful energy that so talented. And I'll never forget, her perfume, she smelled so good. And she was so pleasant, so wonderful to be working with, and such a professional. And that's the reason I really think that her career is where it is, because she's such an angel, like literally. There's no darkness in her whatsoever. And some people have a little bit of that. You know, you never know.
I mean, anything about Barbara Streisand?
Barbara Streisand, yeah. I'm actually right now working on a song in the other room with Barbara Streisand.
Wait, Barbara Streisand is in the other room?
No. Oh. I'm working on a song in the other room.
Okay, Jesus. I want to get her on the line?
Yeah. She's been in my studio a couple of times, but she doesn't like to drive far. She lives in Malibu, and she likes to stay close to home. But I've done five albums for Barbara, and her powerful knowledge of herself, her artistry. I mean, nobody knows better than she knows. Like, she's a real, wonderful man, the legendary voice that comes out of her, and her tape. Like, it's such a hoot working with her, because to this day, I still pinch myself. Like, I just finished Neil Diamond's new album that just came out 2 days ago.
Amazing.
But Barbara is one of those perfectionists. She'll have you, you don't need to go to sleep. No, you got to just keep doing it, man, until it's right, you know.
Wait, okay, so speaking of perfectionism, did you watch, because I know you've worked with David Foster, did you watch the David Foster documentary?
I did not.
Oh, why didn't you watch it?
Well, I kind of have I'm not going to say love-hate relationship with David. I mean, but I think that David has gone down a route, a path that has never been that interesting to me.
Celine's anecdotes about working with him.
Yeah.
He pushes his artists to the point where they're about to break. I forget which song it was, but he made her sing the run, like, and it was like this extremely high note. He made her do it like 30 times, and she claims it was the same thing every time, and he just kept pushing and pushing.
You know, there are those like that. I produced a song, I wrote and produced a song with David for Barbara Streisand and Celine Dion, a duet that they did called Tell Him. And working with David on that song was, it was a little bit like that, because, you know, he has a way of being the boss in the room. I have a more gentle approach with my artists. I'll never push them. I'll never fight with them. I'll never argue with them. I'll never have any of that. And sometimes David has a little bit of that kind of a approach, and I'm not really a fan of that, you know, because I'm more like, there's a reason why you're not doing something that I want you to do, that I know you can do it, but I'm not going to make something out of frustration or anger, or, you know, you know, you need to be in a great place. Like artists are very, very temperamental. They have to be, what they're doing in that into that microphone is going to be their legacy for the whole entire course of time. This exact thing that I'm doing right now needs to be done in a way that I love it. I, the artist, love it. Not you, the you, the producer, have to love it. But this is my record. Like, I'm the boss. I'm the artist. And so if I'm Celine Dion and I'm singing something and I can tell you right now, when I produced Luther Vandross, for instance, Luther Vandross was such an amazing singer. He could do it in one take. I've done singers where I had to take 70 takes. 70. Okay. Now, David Foster, having Celine do something 30 times, that's no big deal. Try making somebody do something 70 times, 50 times, 100 times. So that's our job, you know? If you're a film director, you got to go with what you're getting. You know, I saw this wonderful documentary on Quentin Tarantino. A lot of credit goes to a director when they allow the actor to come up with things on their own, not read the script. That's not in the script. No, forget it. Cut. You know, whatever. No, magic happens if somebody does something that's not according to plan. And David, I don't know if he's more or less like I've discovered in through mistakes, some of the finest things in songs that you could find were done by mistake. Oh my God. Did you record that? Please tell me you recorded that. Okay, great. So it's a living organism. Making music, it's this thing that has to do with temperament and stress levels and being in a zone and being happy, being in love, being like you need to find the magical moment when something so great happens. And sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, you know?
So. You are truly one of the most interesting people that I've spoken to. Thank you. No, I mean, thank you for your time. Such an accomplished, I mean, what a career. It's incredible.
Thank you so very much. It's my pleasure.
What else is on the docket for you? So I know you're working on the Barbra Streisand music right now. Like, do you know what you'll be, are any other artists or projects lined up for 2021?
Yeah, I have three film scores that I'm scoring. And I also have a television show that I kind of am going to be executive producer and probably in, it's a competition show. And we were talking about it for many years, but I've decided to put a show on television every Christmas season called The Search for the Next Great Christmas Song.
Oh, that's so brilliant. Oh, that is brilliant. What network?
Well, right now we were discussing it with Fremantle. There's no network yet, but Fremantle has a very, very wonderful relationship with Fox.
Fremantle produces America's Got Talent, right?
Yeah, America's Got Talent, and there's a little bit of a people love the idea a lot because
brilliant. How did you not think of that 10 years ago?
So we're going to be doing that. We were supposed to do it this year, but we couldn't.
Yeah.
And then also, I have an academy that I started for what the very reasons that we're talking about is for young people or for any people who are in any country, in any capacity of any music-driven, if you're a songwriter, if you want to be a producer, an arranger. But I started an academy called Isina Academy, Isina. You can go to isina.com. And it's literally a mentorship program that will allow anyone to maybe try some things that they haven't tried yet and maybe end up in LA with us and maybe have a very, very good chance at bettering their careers and their hearts for music. So
I love it.
I've got all those things going.
Yeah.
I'm building up my new studio here and I've got my piano. Anybody wants to work with me? Come on. Hi.
Walter, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
To you.
Happy New Year. And thank
Happy
you. Thank you very much. This
thank
is
you
wonderful.
Very much. I'm honored. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Guys, You can follow me, JessXNYC, follow the show account, Hot Takes Deep Dives. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for all your support this year, and have a great holiday season and a great new year.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.